Welcome to Writers' Voices. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and this is a really fun show we have today. Our guest today is Ali Condi, and she is the author of the number one New York Times best-selling Matched trilogy and the co-author of the Dark Deep middle grade series. She's also the author of the novel Summer Lost, an Edgar Award finalist. A former English teacher, Ali lives with her family outside of Salt Lake City, Utah. She has an MFA from the Vermont College of Fine Arts, and she's not the first one of our guests to have that. And she's the founder and director of the nonprofit Write Out Foundation. That's WRITEOUT. So we'll learn a little more about that, too. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Ali.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So let's start out right off the top. Matched. It was published 10 years ago, and it's out with a 10th anniversary edition. How does that feel?
Yes. That feels pretty crazy. I've been saying to people when they ask about it, you know, it does feel like 10 years has passed. Absolutely, because I feel like the last few years have aged us all, 2020 in particular. But it does also feel like it's gone by very, very quickly, which is nice too. You like to feel like, oh, that just blew past. So it's a weird place to be. It does feels like both things have happened.
And
sped up and slowed down.
You know, Matched was the first book of a trilogy, so you've published at least two more books since then, and then you had a whole nother series. So how many books have you published since Matched?
So I have published, wow, that's funny that I can't figure it out. There was the other two books in the trilogy. And then there's a standalone science fiction novel called Atlantia. And there's a middle grade novel called Summer Lost that was nominated for the Edgar Award for Best Juvenile Mystery the year it was published. And then there's a book called The Last Voyage of Poe Blythe, which is a companion novel to the Match series. And then there are the three books in the Dark Deep middle grade series, which is a fun sort of Stranger Things meets the Goonies. So that's eight, it looks like. Which is surprising to me, actually. So, yeah.
8 and 10 years. That is pretty amazing.
It could be worse, for sure.
It certainly could. Now, was Matched your first published book?
Yes and no. So it was my first nationally published book.
Okay.
I had written five novels for a smaller publisher called Shadow Mountain. And at the time that I was writing for them, they were just distributing they were distributing nationwide as well, but largely in Utah. They did have an author who you may have heard of named Brandon Mole, who was publishing with them at the same time. He writes the Fable Haven and Beyonder series. And so he and I were kind of the two that were making the jump to the national market at around the same time. So I had published with a smaller publisher. This was my first national publisher based out of New York.
Now, did you have any books that you wrote like pre-publication? I like to talk about that with authors sometimes because quite a few have, you know, the books that never made it out of the drawer.
Yeah, I do have some of those. And I even have some of those since being published. It's not that everything you write gets published. So,
right,
so I have those
right.
Before. I have those now. But yes, I had written a couple of novels before. My first novel that I ever wrote fully completed did actually get published by Shadow Mountain, the smaller publisher, but I don't even know if you can call it the same novel. I overhauled it so many times by the time it was published. So,
you know, I remember years ago that John Grisham's the first book that he wrote, he couldn't get published. And then many years later, after he became a famous writer, somebody wanted to publish that first book. And I'm guessing, though, that he probably did some rewrites on it before it went out into the world.
I know. I hope so. If not, that would be far too discouraging. So
I know.
We should pretend he did.
I know. But, you know, there have been books that people really had a hard time publishing that ended up being major, major bestsellers. And then you have others that, you know, people, I've talked to authors who sort of just their first attempt makes it big.
It's, yeah.
Yeah. And so I was thinking that that might be you. So I'm actually glad to hear that you had five books with a smaller publisher.
Yeah, I did. And I think in some ways, I think I had the perfect amount of career before I had Matched, because I sometimes joke that I was inoculated against some of the mistakes that you make as a new author, because I got to make them on a smaller scale. So, you know, reading reviews or getting stressed out about revision, I already had known that sometimes people are going to really take you to task online. So I knew that was a thing that happened, and it wasn't so shocking. And I also knew that revision would result in a better product. So I was lucky. I had a chance to sort of try that all out on a smaller scale without really anybody watching. And I was also lucky because I knew to appreciate what happened with Matched. I knew, oh, this isn't a normal thing. This isn't a thing that most people get to have on their first books, or indeed any book. So I was lucky. I'm glad that I got to publish those other smaller books with another smaller press, so that I could appreciate and learn from that experience.
Absolutely. So for those who aren't familiar with it, give us a little synopsis of the Matched trilogy.
Sure. So I was a ninth grade high school English teacher, ninth and 10th grade, and a cross country coach. And I kind of got the idea from that whole experience. On the weekends, I used to chaperone the high school dances because you could make a little extra cash. And every year I would end up chaperoning prom. And it was a really fun, interesting, different night, because we would, at least in Utah where I was, it was junior prom, so it was 11th graders, and everyone would get their date, and then you would announce them as they walked down the red carpeted steps of the state court building, which was a really beautiful old building where they had the dance. And so the dance was, you know, normal, and then they'd have the promenade when everyone did that, and parents would come and take pictures. And it was this really fun, formal night, but also, as we all know, in high school had a dark underside, because everything does. You know, there were kids there who didn't want to be there with the person they were with, or there were people sitting home who didn't get asked, or there were people who were not allowed to come with the person they wanted to come with, because at the time there were restrictions against same-sex or other couples. And so I started thinking about that, like, this is this tradition that is really lovely for a lot of people and kind of a rite of passage, but also not so great for some others. So I started thinking about that when I quit teaching and started having little ones that I needed to stay home with. And I thought, what if that was taken to an evil extreme? This is what authors do. What if instead of going to, you know, to a prom, you were going to a banquet, all dressed up, kind of the same setup, but you're finding out who the government's chosen for you to marry instead of just having a night out. And so that kind of was the initial idea. And that, from that, the rest of the book sprang. I thought, okay, what kind of world would exist where they're deciding who they marry and where they don't have a choice in that? What would that look like? And then I had the main character and the person she was matched with and the person she wished she had been matched with. Because to young people especially, well, to all of us, I think, choosing who to love is the most essential choice and feels like the greatest right we have, or at least one of them, certainly. So that was something I was exploring. And then in the second book, because everything has to get bigger and more important, they're escaping and kind of, it's a more of an adventure story where they're running through the wilderness of southern Utah, where I grew up, that stunning red rock country. And then the third book, there's a global pandemic. So I wish this was 2012 when that was published.
Oh, you,
I have,
yeah.
But yeah, so it kind of gets bigger and bigger and bigger, but at the heart of it is the same question, you know, what happens when we don't get to choose who we love, and her finding out who she is. So those are kind of the storylines for all three books, but the heart of it is one girl finding out who she is.
And the series fits under the genre, I guess, of dystopian young adult fiction.
It does.
And it seems like a lot of young adult fiction, particularly bestsellers, are dystopian. Why do you think that appeals to young adult readers? And maybe we should define dystopian. How do you define it?
Yeah. So I usually say, this is just the description I give when asked, it's a set in a future in a world gone wrong. And so that's just a quick, easy way to say it. But usually it's the government that's overreaching and people that are fighting against it or some of the other constructs. I think it's popular in young adult fiction because that's what life feels like on a daily basis to teenagers. They're always having to push back. They're capable, they're smart, but a lot of their lives are being controlled. And that's one of the times in our life when we realize, hey, I could do more than I'm being allowed to do here. And everyone is sort of pushing back, saying, but you might make a mistake. And I think as parents and other caregivers, teachers, we're always so worried about mistakes. And that's what we have to, I mean, adults still make mistakes. And so that's the answer I would have given is it feels like that to teenagers and it's easily relatable to them. I also think that we like to read, because certainly adults read young adult as well and are
Absolutely.
accountable for part of its popularity. We like to read an extreme version of what we're living because it's scary and interesting, but we also kind of feel like, oh, there's still time to fix this. And I actually think in the last few years that shifted a little where it always felt a bit real. And I think that's why we as readers were drawn to dystopian, but I think it might be feeling almost all too real at this point. And so I'm wondering, I'm interested to see how dystopia plays out the next few years. I think there will always be a place for it, but I'm interested to see if there's any shifts in the writing. With young adult novels, I think a lot of times we want to give a sense of hope. And I found that interesting as well because in this case, in the last few years, I think it's been heartbreaking that they've had to do it. The adults, we should be doing a better job, but you're seeing people like Greta Thunberg and other advocates who are actual children, teenagers, stepping forward and taking the reins where the adults have just absolutely failed. And I find that disturbing and inspiring at the same time. Not disturbing that they're doing it. I think they're wonderful,
No, but
but
disturbing
disturbing
that
that
they
they
have to
that
do
that's
it.
yeah that that's been asked of them basically because we're not doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder too if when things get harder, which they have, hopefully it'll turn around. My 8-year-old granddaughter, yesterday we were talking about, I was saying, okay, next week, Aunt Adrian's going to be here, and the next week is my birthday, and then Christmas, and then New Year's, and then it's 2021. And she goes, and then we get Joe Biden.
Yes,
8 years
we're all
old, and
feeling like
she's
that.
just, yeah.
Yes. And yes, exactly. And then we get Joe
Yeah.
Biden.
She was so excited. And I don't know that at 8 years old I had a clue about.
No, I know. I think you're exactly right. They're so much more aware because, I mean, it's had to be that way.
Yeah, and the impact on them is so much more real, and I don't know that she, that how much direct understanding she has of this, but she's Asian American, and so when our president is out there calling this the China virus, it has a very real
Yeah.
and personal impact.
It does. My daughter is also Asian American and she's 9, so we've got kids and she's noticed that as well. It does.
But anyway, back to Matched. And so you've got this dystopian world where the government, and it does seem like it often is, well, there's two kinds of dystopian worlds. One is anarchical, there's no government and a lot of, there's heroes and evil people fighting. And then the other is the common man versus a dictatorship that completely controlling our lives, the citizens' lives. And in Matched, as and I think this is maybe why even in the real world there are people who are drawn to this authoritarian style of government. The idea is, and there's some basis in reality, that the people's lives are easier because of it. Because the government is making these decisions. So they're matching people based on all kinds of things that are supposed to make for better matches.
Yeah, and you're right. I kind of set this up to be a very orderly government where it's actually kind of working. Because I thought if you're willing to sign away that most personal of choices, which these kids sort of aren't, but generations and generations have been, then there better be something that's working, right? And so the matches are actually kind of working. The government is doing a good job of picking who you should be with, and they've increased health has been better, cancer has been eradicated. All of these things have happened that have made them buy into, okay, if I eliminate these choices, then my life will be this much better. So I think that's the only way I can imagine most of us getting into that is that something positive is coming from it. And I thought about that a lot as I was writing the book, because I was writing it when I was a new parent, and it was disturbing to me, actually, how many choices I would take away from my children in order to keep them safe. I thought, well, I'm not okay with this or that, but if you could tell me this, you know, follow these rules and your child will live till 80 and never get cancer, I mean, what dotted line would you not sign on? You know what I'm saying?
So, yeah.
So that and that was disconcerting to me, because I do think choice is very, very important. So anyway, that was something I was sort of exploring with the government as a parent type government.
I think also to some extent why communism attracted people. If you're living in a nation where, or in a society where you're not sure where your next meal is coming from, and someone comes along and says, follow us and we'll make sure everybody gets fed, and we're going to take from people who have too much and give it to people who don't have enough so that everybody's good, why wouldn't you do that?
Yeah.
Why wouldn't you? If you were starving, why wouldn't you? And so the idea that we then in the United States decided that communism was this evil, I'm not defending the way communism played out, because it didn't actually play out the way it became. It did in many cases become evil. Lenin, Stalin,
absolutely.
But the theory behind it is actually pretty much what Jesus was talking about.
Right. There's all these times throughout history where we've thought, oh, maybe we should all take care of each other, and why, for whatever reason, we just never seem to manage it in a constructive way. So that's kind of what I was thinking about with the book, is why does this never work? And if it works for a time, then what would break it down? So.
Very good point. Very, very interesting. So you are listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Ali Condi, and she's the author of the Matched Trilogy, among other books. And we are celebrating the 10-year anniversary of Matched, which was a New York Times bestseller. Now, were all three books in the trilogy bestsellers?
They were, yeah. They all were on the New York Times list for a bit, and Matched stayed there for over a year, which was really lovely to see.
Oh, yeah, no kidding. Did you always know that you wanted to be a writer?
I did, without really even knowing that. My story writing began when I was so young, I couldn't even write. I had a really sweet babysitter when I was 3 and 4 who would take dictation. So she would write down my stories for me. What a great gift to give a kid. So I have all these hilarious stories that she wrote down for me, and then I started writing on my own. But I was lucky because I have really creative but practical parents. So my mom is a visual artist. She's a painter, and her work's been shown in galleries across the country, but she was also, until she retired, just barely actually, a university art professor. And so I thought, oh, you can be creative, but you might also want to teach. So I think that's how I got into teaching. I thought, I love English, I love writing, this would be a great way to do both. And ironically, the only time I wasn't writing is when I was teaching high school English, because I had 160 ninth grade research papers to grade, So I wrote less than any other time, but I always really hoped I could be a writer, but also was kind of pretty practical about it. It's good to find something else you love too. And in my case, was sort of a lesson from my mom.
So you started writing more seriously after you had children? Is that
Yeah,
true?
I was always a writer in the sense that I was always writing starting stories or novels or had tons of notebooks and files on the computer. But after I stopped teaching, I missed the students so much, and I was home with this sweet little baby, but he did have naps. And so I thought, well, if there's ever a time to do this, why don't I try now, because life's only going to get harder. So that was when I started writing, was during nap time.
And how many kids do you have now?
Now I have four.
You have four kids and you've written 8 books?
I guess 13 books if you count
13
the ones
books
before Madge. Mm-hmm.
Since you started having children.
That's right, yeah.
That sounds kind of impossible. I'm sorry.
Well, sometimes it absolutely feels impossible, but then I'm good friends with Shannon Hale, who also lives in Utah, and she's written 20 something, maybe even 30 something books in a similar amount of time. So it's all relative. We're all just sort of staggering around sleep.
I'm just saying, anyone
can.
Anyone who's using their kids as an excuse for not getting their book done, you just blew it out of the water.
Oh, thank you. But I do have a lot of empathy for that. Oh man, it's hard.
Now, some of your children must be old enough to read these books.
They are, yeah. So my oldest, who is now 17, has read, I think, everything I've written, actually, and he's very great about it and also very honest. So he loves Brandon Sanderson, the science fiction author. Yeah, he stopped doing this, but a couple of years ago, he would grade everything on a scale of 1 to Brandon Sanderson, and I got a 7. So I was honored, because I felt like that was honest and it could have been worse. But it's been fun. And then my 12-year-old and my 9-year-old are reading the Dark Deep series and Summer Lost. And my 12-year-old actually has started the Match series. He's a boy and he's been really into it, which has been fun to see. So that's a payoff that I adore. You hope you reach some kids, to reach your own kids is icing on the cake.
Oh, absolutely. And there used to be kind of an assumption that boys would only read stories with boy protagonists and girls would read
either one.
Do you think that has changed?
I think we're getting better about that. I certainly think there's still a long way to go. Parents will sometimes self-select for children and other authority figures, but I think kids are, you know, my son is super athletic, smart, soccer boy, and he has no shame about carrying around the book with a girl on the cover, and I think that's how it should be. You know, girls aren't ashamed about having a book with a boy on the cover, and I hope as a society we can continue to encourage and facilitate that.
I agree. So tell me a little bit more about the Dark Deep. Is that what it's called, the Dark Deep series?
Yeah, so that's a fun series that I write with my co-author Brendan Reichs. Brendan and I have been friends for, probably about 10 years. Matched, and his Virals book came out around the same time, and we just had a lot of paths crossing, and we both got put on the board of a book festival called Y'all Fest / Y'all West, which are two sister festivals for young adults. So, again, lots of paths crossing. And then you mentioned that I got an MFA from the Vermont College of Fine Arts, and I actually did that from 2015 to 2017, so fairly recently. And Brendan was one of the only other authors I knew who had already been published and hit the New York Times list, and then also thought, hey, I want to go back to school and learn how to do this better. We were both really interested in craft. And so we ended up at VCFA without planning it at the same time and got to know each other there as well, kind of as writers, not just colleagues. And we thought, hey, it would be really fun to write a book together. So we're both kids who grew up in the 80s, and we wanted to write something that felt kind of like The Goonies, if you remember that.
I do.
Movie, just friends solving mysteries and having adventures. And Stranger Things came out around the time we were brainstorming, and that is set in the 80s as well. Our book isn't, but it has that same feeling of kids figuring things out, like a very fun friendship group. And we thought, let's write something like that together. That would be really fun. So it's a middle grade series about these kids who live on the coast in Washington in a small town called Timbers. And they find a mysterious old houseboat And in the houseboat is this pool, which doesn't make sense because it should sink. It's sort of mysterious. They check that out and they call it the Dark Deep, and it turns what they're thinking about into reality. And that's sort of the springboard premise for the series. Of course, other things happen as well, but it's a fun friendship tale. We had a ton of fun writing it, and that's been a great pleasure I've discovered in writing as co-authoring, because you have someone else who cares about the book as much as you do to talk about with it. So that's been really great.
And how does that work for you? Do you take turns writing chapters? Do you write different, like, are different chapters from different point of view, and each of you have a separate character point of view that you're writing?
Yeah. So yes and no. We really wanted the book to feel cohesive, and it's a third person point of view, close third person, with a male narrator and a female narrator, and we each write those separately. But we didn't want it to feel jarring, and we wanted it to feel really smooth. So the process we came up with is we would fly to New York. We live in different states. We would fly to New York for 4 days. Obviously, this is all pre-pandemic. Mm-hmm. We'd lock ourselves in a room with our editor and a giant whiteboard, and we'd outline the whole book. And then we'd go home and begin writing it. And so he would write the odd chapters. That was the boy narrator. And I would write the even. And then we would both go over each other's stuff. So the process for the first draft was Brendan would write chapter one and send it to me. I would revise chapter one, edit it for him, write chapter two and send it back. And then he would go back, see what I'd said about chapter one, revise accordingly, edit my chapter two, write chapter three, send it back, you know, on and on and on. So by the time we even finished the first draft, there had been three full passes on every chapter. And it felt pretty cohesive. And there were lines, we always told the story because it was funny and so true. Brendan said, this was somewhere later in the process, maybe when we were editing the copy editing, he said, I just love that joke you made in chapter whatever. And I said, actually, you made that joke several drafts ago, but we couldn't even remember who had written what largely by the end.
You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Ali Condi, author of Matched and the Matched Trilogy and the Dark Deep series. So did that same process continue through all the books in that series?
It did, yeah. And we realized it was fun because we both started to learn a lot from each other. And also we kind of got into a groove. Brendan would often kick off, well, actually every time, he would be the initial opening chapter and I would get to do the final chapter. And he really loves writing beginnings and I really love writing endings. So there were some things like that that we made sure we did every time. But yeah, it worked so well with the first draft that we ended up doing it with all three.
Would you like to read a little bit from Matched for us?
Yes, I thought about a lot of different spots, but I'm just going to read the opening of the book. So chapter one. Now that I found the way to fly, which direction should I go into the night? My wings aren't white or feathered. They're green, made of green silk, which shudders in the wind and bends when I move. First in a circle, then in a line, finally in a shape of my own invention. The black behind doesn't worry me, neither do the stars ahead. I smile at myself at the foolishness of my imagination. People cannot fly, though before the society, there were myths about those who could. I saw a painting of them once. White wings, blue sky, gold circles above their heads, eyes turned up in surprise as though they couldn't believe what the artist had painted them doing, couldn't believe that their feet didn't touch the ground. Those stories weren't true, I know that, but tonight it's easy to forget. The air train glides through the starry night so smoothly and my heart pounds so quickly that it feels as though I could soar into the sky at any moment. What are you smiling about? Xander wonders as I smooth the folds of my green silk dress down neat. Everything, I tell him, and it's true. I've waited so long for this, for my match banquet, where I'll see, for the first time, the face of the boy who will be my match. It will be the first time I hear his name. I can't wait. As quickly as the air train moves, it still isn't fast enough. It hushes through the night, its sound a background for the low rain of our parents' voices, the lightning quick beats of my heart. Perhaps Xander can hear my heart pounding, too, because he asks, are you nervous? In the seat next to him, Xander's older brother begins to tell my mother the story of his match banquet. It won't be long now until Xander and I have our own stories to tell. No, I say, But Xander's my best friend. He knows me too well. You lie, he teases. You are nervous, aren't you? Not me. I'm ready. He says it without hesitation, and I believe him. Xander is the kind of person who is sure about what he wants. It doesn't matter if you're nervous, Kasia, he says, gentle now. Almost 93% of those attending their match banquet exhibit some signs of nervousness. Did you memorize all of the official matching material? Almost, Xander says, grinning. He holds his hands out as if to say, what did you expect? The gesture makes me laugh, and besides, I memorized all of the material too. It's easy to do so when you read it that many times when the decision is so important. So you're in the minority, I say, the 7% who don't show any nerves at all. Of course, he agrees. How could you tell I was nervous? Because you keep opening and closing that. Xander points to the golden object in my hands. I didn't know you had an artifact. A few treasures from the past float around among us. Though citizens of the society are allowed one artifact each, they are hard to come by, unless you had ancestors who took care to pass things along through the years. I didn't until a few hours ago, I tell him. Grandfather gave it to me for my birthday. It belonged to his mother. What's it called? Xander asks. A compact, I say. I like the name very much. Compact means small. I am small. I also like the way it sounds when you say it. Compact. Saying the word makes a sound like the one the artifact itself makes when it snaps shut. What do the initials and numbers mean? I'm not sure. I run my finger across the letters ACM and the numbers 1940 carved across the golden surface. But look, I tell him, popping the compact open to show him the inside, a little mirror made of real glass and a small hollow where the original owner once stored powder for her face, according to grandfather. Now, I use it to hold the three emergency tablets that everyone carries, one green, one blue, one red. That's convenient, Xander says. He stretches out his arms in front of him, and I notice that he has an artifact, too, a pair of shiny platinum cufflinks. My father lent me these, but you can't put anything in them. They're completely useless. They look nice, though. My gaze travels up to Xander's face, to his bright blue eyes and blonde hair above his dark suit and white shirt. He's always been handsome, even when we were little, but I've never seen him dressed up like this. Boys don't have as much leeway in choosing clothes as girls do. One suit looks much like another. Still, they get to select the color of their shirts and cravats, and the quality of the material is much finer than the material used for our everyday plain clothes. You look nice. The girl who finds out that he's her match will be thrilled. Nice, Xander says, lifting his eyebrows. That's all. Xander, his mother says next to him, amusement mingled with reproach in her voice. You look beautiful, Xander tells me, and I flush a little, even though I've known Xander all my life. I feel beautiful in this dress, ice green, floating, full-skirted. The unaccustomed smoothness of silk against my skin makes me feel lithe and graceful. Next to me, my mother and father each draw a breath as City Hall comes into view, lit up white and blue and sparkling with the special occasion lights that indicate a celebration is taking place. I can't see the marble stairs in front of the hall yet, but I know they will be polished and shining. All my life, I have waited to walk up those clean marble steps and through the doors of the hall, a building I have seen from a distance but never entered. I want to open the compact and check in the mirror to make sure I look my best, but I don't want to seem vain, so I sneak a glance at my face and its surface instead. The rounded lid of the compact distorts my features a little, but it's still me. My green eyes, my coppery brown hair, which looks more golden in the compact than it does in real life, my straight small nose, my chin with a trace of a dimple like my grandfather's, all the outward characteristics that make me Kasia Maria Reyes, 17 years old exactly. And I think that's about 6 minutes.
All right. Thank you. And that was
no
Ali Condi reading from Matched, and that should pique your interest if you're when you're listening to this.
I hope so.
So there is another book that's coming out around the same time as this golden edition of Matched.
Yes.
And that's The Last Voyage of Poe Blythe.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about that.
So that is the novel that was just released last year, and the new paperback version just came out in November, along with the golden anniversary edition of Matched. And The Last Voyage of Poe Blythe is a companion novel, so it's not a direct sequel in the series, but it's a novel about another character in that world. And this is a very different novel from Madge. You could probably get the sense from that opening reading that it's a book where someone thinks they have something and then they realize that their life is a bit of a lie. But Poe Blythe is a story where in the opening chapter, she loses everything. And the rest of the book is about her getting it back. It's a bit of a revenge novel. So it has a very different feel. It's a very different character and narrator, but there is some crossover from the Match series. There's one character who appears in the novel that was also in the Match series. And it's a different part of that world, sort of the Wild West outposty part of the world that you don't get to see much of in Match in the series. So that was very fun to write. I actually did not intend to write a companion novel. I thought this was something completely independent, Poe's story. And then partway through the book, this character that I mentioned earlier from the Match series wandered on, and I thought, but it wasn't a conscious decision initially. So it's fun to have both of those books releasing with new covers at the same time.
Now, do you think there are some other stories from this universe waiting to be told?
I think there could be. I'm not certain about which ones or when at this point. But yes, I do feel like there are characters who didn't get their full time in the sun. I feel like there's things that happened before and after the trilogy that would be interesting to explore. So I would never say never to revisiting the world.
Some of the best young adult fiction, kind of sci-fi fiction that I've always loved was the Ender's Game series. And that, you know, started out, there's all kinds of prequels and all kinds of sequels and all kinds of companion. It's like this huge broad universe. I love that. And of course, Star Wars is kind of like that too, in movies, not books, but you start from one point, but the world itself is so intriguing that, or Game of Thrones, for heaven's sakes.
Yes, exactly. You know, so much.
Yeah, although in the book form, of course, it was Tales of Fire and Ice or something like that. It wasn't called Game of Thrones originally. The whole world creation aspect, is that as much fun for you as the character creation?
You know, I hate to be so honest about it, but no, it's not. That's not to say I don't enjoy the world creation, but I always build the world around the character. The character is the first thing to me and the most important. I do love a good setting very, very much. It's actually one of my favorite things to read is a good setting, but I do come to character first when I'm writing myself. And so the world is always built around what I want the character to do and experience rather than vice versa. That's not to say that they're not shaped by their environment or it doesn't go back and forth in drafts where I realize, oh, in this world, she actually couldn't do that. Certainly there's interplay, but yes, the character comes first for me.
But in Matched, it doesn't seem like there's really any, the laws of physics aren't any different than our world.
No, it's not fantastical. It's not paranormal. It's not magical, really, in any way. It's just a futuristic novel. Yeah. Yes, exactly. The laws of physics remain the same.
Whereas in Deep Dark, it sounds like there is more of an element of supernatural and paranormal and all of those things.
So, yeah, absolutely. We played around with that quite a bit there.
So we talked earlier about that you went to get your MFA at Vermont College of Fine Arts after you were already a successful writer because of your interest in craft. But I'm curious a little what was the real, like, yes, this is what I'm going to do. What made you make that decision?
Well, honestly, it was realizing that it was kind of now or never. So I had wanted to go to that program. I'd known some people who had gone since before I published Match, and I'd always wanted to get a master's degree, and I'd always wanted to take a creative writing course. I'd never taken one. I just always was in the English education department, so I learned how to teach creative writing, but I never got to do any myself. So I just really, really wanted to do it, and things kind of came together for me. It's never a good time when you're a parent of small children, but we did get to a point where everyone could sort of feed themselves a little bit at least. And I realized they were about to go into high school, and the first one. And I thought, oh, that's such a critical time. There's no uncritical time or non-critical, but you know what I mean. So I thought, let's just get this done. And I also could pay for it. I had earned enough money that I felt fine about spending some of it on this degree that I had kind of beforehand felt like I didn't have the right to ask for money to do from my spouse. So I decided to just take the plunge. And the great thing about that program is it is low residency. So you only have to go 11 days twice a year, which is a huge sacrifice for your family and for you and for your kids. But for me, at least, getting out the door once for 11 days to go to school was easier than trying to get out the door every day, if that makes sense. So I thought, this is good for a parent. We can figure this out. My mom was super supportive. I had a great babysitter at the time. So we just made it happen. And I have never been more grateful that I've done something. I learned so much about craft. And I think I'm a better writing teacher because of it, too. And always at the back of my mind, I would love to go back someday and teach it as well.
The first time that you went for the residency portion, so you say 11 days, I would imagine that that was probably the first time in many years that you'd had time to yourself, 24 hours a day.
and it was terrifying. I felt very adrift and weird. And in fact, partway through, I said, I'm not going to come back. Even though everyone was very nice and it was a great environment, I thought, I can't do this. This just feels too strange. But then as it went on, I loved it more and more. And I realized for the first time, the only thing that was expected of me in that environment was, well, to be, you know, a decent citizen, but also to learn. And when in your adult life do you have the chance where all that's asked of you is to learn? It was such a privilege. And so that was the part that I just could not get enough of, and indeed still miss, is walking into a room just to learn.
It sounds so appealing to me. I keep thinking that someday I'll do something like that. I dropped out of college my freshman year.
Because
I had a baby, and I've been a grown up my whole life since I was 18.
Yeah.
And, you know, now I have grandkids and I have businesses and a lot of responsibilities. But I've always thought, mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be great to have that opportunity just to learn just whatever I wanted, just to explore.
Yes.
It'd be different than doing it as a younger person, because I don't have to think about whether I'm going to make a living at what I'm learning. I'm almost to retirement, almost, you know.
Yeah, you're almost more grateful for it. And I don't know. Yeah, exactly.
And every time I'm on a college campus, I get that yearning to have that experience, which I never really got to have. For many years, I thought, well, I'll do it before my kids are in college. Well, that year came and went. Now maybe I'll do it before my grandkids are in college.
No, that was one of the lovely things about the program is we had, I think in my class, we had someone just out of college, so 22. And then they were so fun too. And they didn't know each other until the program, but two former lawyers in their 70s who were fantastic writers. And then everything in the middle too. It that breadth of experience too, you don't always get in a typical college course. So that was wonderful as well.
Now back to Matched, you know, in this concept of the government matching people. In reality, people being able to choose their own life partners is kind of a recent development and not even all that common, not even everywhere in the world is that allowed.
Exactly. We feel like it's so inalienable and unassailable, and actually it's a pretty rare thing.
It is. And I wonder if the people who still practice arranged marriage, and so certainly even people coming from other cultures to the United States still want to do that. And I have a number of friends who they don't want to have arranged marriages, but they use like astrology to try and determine
yes.
whether someone's right for them or something. I wonder if it really is more or less successful to marry for love as compared to having your family choose who you're going to marry.
I think it's such an interesting question because your parents do love you and look out for you, but they are also going to make decisions that perhaps you would not make or have other things in mind. I mean, a good parent is always going to make a decision, but even a good parent can make so many mistakes. And I do think it's interesting that where we don't have the hand of maybe a parent or a government, we kind of look for another hand, the hand of God or magic or fate or destiny or our one true partner. We always, even when we're
or an algorithm
opportunity, yes, even when we're given the opportunity to choose, we almost want there to be something bigger at play as well. So it's interesting. Love is interesting.
Yeah. What do you think of the dating sites that use an algorithm to match people up?
I think it's pretty fascinating. I mean, I have a brother who met his wife on eHarmony.
Really?
And I think and she's an amazing person. And of course, they dated in person quite a long time. And I think they may have the best marriage of all of it. I mean, who knows? So I do think it's really like anything else, can be positive or cannot.
You know, yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right. And I have heard of successful matches in eHarmony. Didn't work for me, but I wasn't really very into it
and
either.
It doesn't work for a lot of people. Yeah. So who knows?
I couldn't get into it because the problem I had is they were matching you up with somebody, and the person knew that you were being matched, and it hurt my feelings to have to reject people, you know.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And I'm like, I don't want to do this. And it hurt my feelings to be rejected before somebody had even talked to me. And I'm like, why? Yes. Why are they rejecting me? And so I just didn't want to do it.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, the other thing that came up in your bio that I wanted to ask you about was the Write Out Foundation, what that is and what your involvement with it is.
Yeah, thank you so much for asking about it. I love talking about it. Right now we're shuttered but we're not holding our writing camp due to COVID, just like everybody else right now. But what it is, and we've had it for 3 years until 2020 was the first summer we hadn't had it again because of COVID. But I grew up in a small town in Utah, a really great small town, because it was positioned or still is at the gateway to a lot of the gorgeous national parks in that area, Zion and Bryce Canyon and others. But I was also in a place where we never got author visits, and we had a small bookstore that kind of just petered out. We didn't have books. We did have a good public library, but it was not a place that was, I guess, that a lot of writers came. There were definitely some, I'm sure, but not a lot that I knew about as a kid. So I thought about all those kids who lived there and in even more rural areas. Even I had the town that had the Walmart, you know, people drove into shops, but there were tons of other smaller scattered places around. And I thought, this is just, there's so many writers and kids out there with big things to say and wonderful work in them. And I wonder how we could reach them. So we started having a writing camp in 2017, would have been our first year. And I would get author friends to come out. And so for 3 days, we teach the kids on campus about writing. We have workshops with published authors. And then we also take them on a hike and an excursion to do some nature writing and to go to one of the national parks in the area, because that's another thing that sometimes happens is we live on the doorstep of these beautiful things and kids don't always get taken out to see them. And then we also have a world-renowned Tony Award-winning Shakespeare Festival in Cedar City, where I grew up. So we would also take the kids to a Shakespeare play and have a costume ball and do all of these fun things. And we scholarshiped 20 of those students from areas that could not have afforded to otherwise through donations. So, and we only take 100 kids. So a fifth to a quarter, actually, it usually ended up being a quarter of our students were scholarshiped from very, very rural at-risk areas. And it was the most, I feel like it's one of the most fulfilling, productive, awesome things that I've ever gotten to do. And we're still up and running. If you want to visit our website at Write Out, it's spelled WriteOut.org. We are going to be up and running again, we hope, in the future, because we had the best time. And all of the other authors who used to come, they donated their time. Basically, we paid them very little, and they just took these kids under their wing for 3 days and hiked with them and taught them. And it was truly a labor of love on their part, and I'm so grateful.
Now, was it all local kids?
No, anyone from around the country could come, but we only scholarshiped people from rural Utah.
Okay. And so it was a sleepover camp?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Very cool. Very cool. I'm just looking at the website now, and you're, there's two Allies on there.
Yes, Allie Carter, who you probably have heard of. She's a very famous young adult author, and we got her to come 1 year. Brandon Mole came every year. Shannon Hale came. Brendan Reich, my co-author, came. We had the best. Oh, Soman Chainani, who writes The School for Good and Evil, he's fantastic, so he came as well. And I remember one night we do a night of student readings, and a student read something that just blew us all away, and he leaned over to me and said, "That kid is already better than any of us will be." And we all smiled and knew it was true. I mean,
have you been able to stay in touch with that kid to know what he's doing?
A bit. Yeah. They usually will check in, and often actually they end up leaving with writers groups that they form on their own. We don't set those up, and they keep writing and emailing each other.
Oh, that's
so it's been pretty fun to see. Yeah.
That's great. Well, speaking of writing, that was something that in the Matched universe had been basically eliminated. Both.
Yes.
Any type of creative writing, and all but 100 poems. Were there any books allowed?
No, I never say that there are any books. There are 100 stories, so there are tales, fables that they allow to be in the canon, but no, and there's not really a lot of much longer form fiction than a story. There's only 100 pieces of art, all of that. And I got that idea from, sometimes we make these lists of, you know, the 100 best songs of the decade or whatever, and then everything that isn't on the list sort of gets forgotten about. And I thought, what if that were taken to an extreme?
And that's like one of the saddest parts of this whole world that Cassia lives in. I just can't imagine. No books,
yeah.
No fiction, no, every leisure minute was accounted for.
Mm-hmm. And no personality. Yeah.
Yeah. And career. I, you know, she was being trained or practicing to become a sorter, which I'm some kind of analyst kind of. But there didn't seem to be a whole lot of career options. Not only did you get selected to do it, you didn't get to choose, but was there even much variety in work?
Yeah, exactly. And that was the other thing, is those lists tend to be white male dominated, very homogenous, canon type. And there's good, you know, I'm a huge fan of Dylan Thomas, who's as white and male as it gets. But these lists are always curated with that skew and that bend. And it's disturbing to see, because hardly anyone can see themselves in that. And it's frankly not always the best work. So that was another thing I was thinking about.
Yeah. Yeah. And the just not being able, it's just like so sad why that people would, but I do know people who would go along with that,
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. They don't want to be thinking and learning and creating and yeah. And how much of the last 10 years do you feel like your books were almost a prediction of?
It's been, like I said earlier, disconcerting to see that. And I could see already the deterioration of handwriting and people sort of losing that and cursive not being taught anymore. And I'm not trying to be a fossil and say, let's spend time on that when there's other things they need to learn more. But I do think we lose something with handwriting when there's a personality to it. You can identify someone by it. Everyone's is different rather than tapping out things on a screen. So I do, there are things like that that I see coming to fruition that I feel bad about. There are certainly ways that kids have gotten very creative online and created and drawn and made worlds, you know, and beautiful things. So I'm not trying to sound like a complete technology naysayer, but I do think that we work a different part of our brain when we're not online. There's texture, there's physicality to it that I really don't want us to lose.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. And some of the things, you're right, that you can do with computers creatively are really amazing. But
yeah,
I hadn't really thought about, I knew that they had stopped teaching cursive in schools, and that's something that my mother, who's often co-host with me here, who, and she was an English teacher, and she's now 85 and retired, but she really laments the loss of cursive writing. The point she makes is no one's going to be able to read these historical documents if we don't learn cursive.
Yeah.
Like the Constitution, even, or the Declaration of Independence. But it never really occurred to me that printing itself may actually, hand printing, you know, not just cursive, but any kind of handwriting is kind of disappearing, because if you're typing everything on a computer, when do you actually have a chance to write things down? I don't write checks anymore, almost never.
Right. Hardly ever, yeah. And writing a letter is still so special, you know. What am I writing this for, a grand occasion? When do we really write letters?
Yeah, and half the time, if I'm writing a letter, I write it on the computer, print it out, and mail it. You know, it's so, are we going to not even write at all? Ugh.
Yeah.
Do you ever write by hand when you're writing?
All the time. So I type on the computer because it's much faster, but when I get stuck, I write by hand. It works a different part of my brain. That's something I've done organically, not consciously, but that's a pattern. And I also only outline by hand. It's very, very strange. I can't, if I type an outline, it doesn't feel the same to me as if I write it out by hand in a notebook and then follow it.
Well, I still have notebooks for everything. So I'm right there.
Oh, yeah.
With
I have
you.
Notebooks everywhere. I write my kids' notes in their lunch. Yes, I still do write quite a lot.
Well, Allie, we are out of time, but it's really been a pleasure talking with you today. And I loved your book. I'm a big fan of young adult kind of dystopian fiction. I've read most of it. I somehow had missed yours, so now I'm going to have to go back and read them all.
Oh, thank you, Monica. Thank you for saying that and for giving me the time today. This has been just a lovely conversation.
Well, you're very welcome, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.